I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In the history of legal strategies in this country, one that ranks at the top is a successful attack on the tobacco industry. Much of what worked then is being used again, and this time the target is Big Pharma's marketing of opioids. One of the attorneys involved in this legal battle will explain the strategy and what to expect from the outcome. Then, a look at the remarkable start of the Chiefs season and the latest in a line of great quarterbacks, Patrick Mahomes. We'll see how the rookie starter stacks up, and we'll bring you this month's A Fan's Notes. Finally, Brian McTavish will wrap things up with the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Back in the 1990s, a man named Mike Moore, who was Mississippi's attorney general, launched a lawsuit against 13 tobacco companies that eventually resulted in a $246 billion 50-state settlement. But when he began, even Moore's mother questioned his judgment, given the deep pockets of the nation's cigarette makers. Now Moore is back at it again, taking on the nation's pharmaceutical companies, which he says are responsible for the nation's opioid epidemic, which, of course, has wreaked havoc in Missouri and Kansas. Opioid addiction in the U.S. has increased sixfold since 1999, and overdoses now claim more than 115 lives a day. Joining us now is one of the lawyers working with Mike Moore, and his name is a familiar one around Missouri. That's Chip Robertson. He's a former judge on the Missouri Supreme Court who served as Chief Justice of that court from 1991 to 1993. These days, he heads up the appellate practice and class action division of the Bartimus Frickleton Robertson Rader firm based in Leawood and Jefferson City. Chip, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Steve, great to be with you again. Thanks.
How did a former Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court end up fighting Big Pharma?
Well, I became friends with Mike Moore as a result of the tobacco litigation. And Mike is one of the most unusual human beings I've ever met.
Unusual how?
He may be the most honest politician I've ever met in my life.
No kidding.
He's a Boy Scout, and he made not a nickel off of the big tobacco settlement.
Is that right?
Not a single nickel beyond what his salary as Attorney General of Mississippi was. And turned down job offers from law firms that had made some money because he never wanted to be tainted with the fact that he had an ulterior motive. And he's done everything in his life that way.
So when he came calling to work on the opioid case, you were right there with him again.
Well, I've had the great privilege of working with him on some other stuff. He has a nephew who has had a tremendous difficulty with opioids. He got into, as Mike does, into the deep end very, very quickly. He began to see that you can start off with a sprained ankle, which is what happened with his nephew, and suddenly you're addicted, and the only place you can get your quote-unquote fix is to head for the street corner. And the doctors give you a 30-day prescription for something because they don't want you to have pain, and the pharmaceutical company said, well, this isn't addictive. And the next thing you know, we've got more people dying annually from opioid overdoses than died in all of the Vietnam War.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, how similar, in your view, Chip, is this case, the opioid case that's being fought now versus the cigarette case back in the 1990s?
Well, somebody once told me that really smart people can see how things are the same, but geniuses can figure out how they're different. It's same in that you have a legal theory that was successful in tobacco being used against the big pharma. And that is that these states, cities, and counties encounter significant costs in dealing with not only the health issues, but the crime issues and all of the things related to that because of opioids. And they're asking that the people who profited from the sales contribute to the cost that they have had the problems that the sales brought about.
So it's a coalition, once again, that's being formed, much as was the case back in the 1990s.
This one's a little bit different, and that's because it was mostly states in the 1990s. Because of the success of the tobacco litigation, first, and secondly, because the devastation that's been wrecked as a result of this opioid thing has filtered all through every level of government. You have counties and cities who are participating at a much larger scale than they ever did during the days of tobacco litigation.
How difficult is it to, I'm guessing it's like herding cats, getting this coalition together and trying to lead this group forward in this fight against the pharmaceutical industry?
Well, it's not difficult for them to have a common purpose, and that's easy to sort of line folks up and headed that way. The problem is that there's a much more finite amount of money that's going to be available in this case.
You told our producers that, and that surprised me a little bit. I think of Big Pharma as having access to bucks just like tobacco did so many years ago.
Well, it's not all opioid bucks, and you know they're gonna claim that, you know, even if we're liable for something, we're not liable for this penicillin we sold over here.
Oh, I see.
And of course, it's all profits, and so you know there may be a way to get to some of that, but an awful lot of this is generic manufacturers who run on some pretty thin margins, and you've also got these distributors who really should have known as things went through their ordering systems that, wait a minute, we're sending a million pills to this little town in West Virginia. They're in. Tobacco was different in that you had a group of addicted people who would continue to buy the product and be able to buy the product. At the end of the day, part of the resolution of this case is going to be you're going to only be able to sell opioids in a different way than you do it now, where they're
a more limited way.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not going to have this steady stream of income from the product that was, and it is still available to tobacco. Tobacco is still paying on that big judgment that you mentioned at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
They had 25 years to do it. This is a different economic model, substantially different.
Is the original sin here, Chip, of Big Pharma, this notion that you've already alluded to, that the pharmaceutical industry said over and over and over again that these drugs, these opioids, would not be habit-forming? Is that the issue here?
Well, the real problem came when one of the companies, Purdue Pharma, figured out how to do time-release opioids in a drug called OxyContin.
Mm-hmm.
And Oxy was sold to physicians to prescribe, basically with a plan or a test that they had, pharma said they had run, that said, look, these are not going to be addictive because they're time release and whatever. And so they even had their salespeople pronounce OxyContin sort of like it sounded like oxycodone, so that people would hear that, doctors would hear that and say, well, codeine is not addictive, so therefore this is probably something like that. And every doctor, the good, the bad, and, you know, the indifferent, doesn't like a patient with pain. And, you know, I've talked to lots of people who had a wisdom tooth pulled or had a sprained ankle or, you know, broke a finger, and they get a 30-day supply of this stuff. And we're taught when we go to the doctor, when you get penicillin or some antibiotic, finish this.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so we get 30 days worth of these pills, and our natural inclination, if we're a compliant patient, is to say, okay, well, this is like every other prescription I get. I got to finish it. If you take this stuff for 21 days, you're hooked.
Just 21 days is
yes.
All it takes. Yeah. And why is that? What is it about these drugs that causes that?
Well, you know, I don't know the brain chemistry and all the others. The experts in the case will be able to say that. But there is a very, very addictive quality to this stuff. It not only relieves pain, it and I've never done it, so I can't tell you, but it's described as this sense that the world is all right.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only does the pain go away, but so does a lot of other things. The heroin people that I've talked to basically say that the happiest moment is their life is their first heroin hit. And that's got to be the same with this stuff because it attacks the same parts of the brains or advances itself into those same parts.
Chip Robertson is my guest. He's a former Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court. He's now a lawyer fighting a case against Big Pharma. Has the case been formally filed yet, Chip?
Well, a lot of them have. They've all been... This is where it gets complicated procedurally, but states cannot be taken into federal court. That was one of the things about the tobacco litigation. The tobacco companies had to fight a standalone piece of litigation in every state that filed. Here, these counties and cities filed, and they can be taken into federal court because of the diversity aspects of federal jurisdiction. And so that's all been assembled. Those state and the county and city cases have been assembled in what's called multi-district litigation in Cleveland, Ohio. And because there's so many people that have been drains on county and city budgets, there's hundreds of these cases. So the judge has put together a group of leaders from both the plaintiffs and the defendants to try and figure out ways to resolve this litigation. The state cases are not in that multi-district litigation. They're still in the state courts for the most part. Some of the attorneys general decided to file in federal court, and so they're there. But you can't have a global settlement that basically doesn't include everybody. So Mike Moore is there. We represent five or six states, and we have not tried to represent a bunch of counties and cities. We do have a few, but they're really major ones. Largely to make sure that the states are part of the conversation. And at the end of the day, there's going to have to be some very everybody's going to have to give a lot. A complicated formula is going to come up that says if there's $100 recovered, X is going to go to the states, X is going to go to the counties, and X is going to go to the cities. And X will be a factor of number of people and the value of the claim and all the rest of it.
So no question money is being sought here. Has there been a dollar amount put forward, Chip, that is sort of the operational number here?
Well, you hear all kinds of numbers.
Right, sure.
But, you know, I talked to the lawyer for Huntington, West Virginia, and that city alone has a claim that's close to $300 million.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not a big city. So at the end of the day, the number is in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And so then the question is it going? How do you spend it if you get it? Let's assume you got all of that money. And there's a big fight going on both sides of the case is what can we do? We can't, this case is not about compensating people who lost loved ones. I mean, it's not personal injury or wrongful death. So what's left is you've got these expenses that you've already spent and you're going to have some going forward. And how do we figure out a way to sort of give something for what's out of your pocket, but do some prevention here that keeps this from becoming a long-term problem at the same level that it has been in the past. So then the question becomes, you know, what's the best use of the money? And the experts say, well, some say prevention is really where you ought to throw most of the money. A bunch more say, well, wait a minute, you know, we've lost all this much money. We need that back. So this is complicated times two.
Has the opioid industry responded in the sense that they aren't prescribing, doctors aren't prescribing the way they used to, or do you still see a big problem out there?
Well, I mean, we don't see it very quickly. The federal government has gotten involved. It's got all the data. It knows because these companies have to report. So I suspect it's slowed down a little bit, but you still have these pill mills going in poverty-stricken places. This is a tragedy unlike any we've seen in healthcare in this country in a long, long time.
What about the states of Missouri and Kansas? Are they part of the lawsuit that you're involved with?
Missouri has filed a lawsuit. Kansas has talked to lawyers, and I honestly don't know whether they have filed one or not. We're not representing them.
Yeah. Are the members of the coalition, are they mostly Democrats or Republicans, or is it everybody in the same basket here?
Well, the biggest state that's filed was Ohio, one of our clients. And Mike DeWine was a former United States senator. He's a Republican. He was attorney general.
Right.
He's now running for governor. And it's bipartisan, I guess, is the best way to say it. This is a problem that doesn't understand the difference between an elephant and a donkey.
Yeah, yeah. Again, Chip Robertson is my guest. He's a lawyer, a former chief judge of the Missouri Supreme Court. We're talking about the ongoing fight against Big Pharma in connection with the opioid epidemic. Will the tobacco strategy be as effective this time, because that case is so well known, Chip, and Big Pharma will have a pretty good idea what to expect here?
Well, this is another one of the differences. In tobacco, as you mentioned at the beginning, there are 13 different companies, but really 6 or 7 of those were less than 10% of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the tobacco companies for years had cooperated with one another in what was called the Tobacco Research Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to be able to prove that tobacco didn't cause cancer. So they were used to working together. In this case, these people are all competitors and they have not worked together, particularly the distributors. They are at each other's throat all the time trying to get business. And one of the lawyers from the defense side that I've had a chance to speak with said, this is so complicated because my people won't even talk to the other defendants right now.
Hmm. Wow. And that complicates things real quickly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because if you could get everybody in each room sort of saying, okay, we're going to pay, okay, we'll accept a certain amount of money, then you can have a negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody's pointing at everybody else in the defendant's room. And the plaintiffs aren't pure either. Everybody's saying, well, look, you know, we've spent all of this money. We're in Eastern Ohio, Western Pennsylvania, you know, West Virginia, which is Kentucky. That's where this stuff's really the worst.
Right.
We should have more. So we're a long way from the end.
What's your theory as to why this crisis spun out of control to the extent that it did? What happened here?
It's really hard to say, but I think it started, as so many things do, with reasonably good intentions. Look, here's a pill that you can take that will solve the problem without causing another problem. It was a lie. Mm-hmm. The people that sold it knew it was a lie. And so the doctors started handing it out. And there's a lot of actors in this that make it worse. For instance, hospitals are rated by CMS, the Medicare group, on how they treat pain. So if they want a good rating from the patient when they come out, the patient wants to say, I'm pain-free. Well, there's a pretty good darn way to do that.
Yeah.
And so, this was just too easy to solve the problem, and the law of unintended consequences came here and just bowled everything over.
You know, what about, Chip, those who have chronic pain, who will need opioid strength medications for extended periods here, possibly even for life? How are they going to be affected by all this?
Well, it's a great question, but this is not about getting the place where medicine can't solve a problem. It's getting to the place where medicine doesn't create another problem by solving the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's always going to be available. There's going to be some rough spots at the end of the day as the government or this judgment or however it comes down says, you've got to be really careful about how you do this. Don't give out more than 3 days worth of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody needs to come back, let them come back. But after they've had it for 30 days, don't keep giving them another 30, because at that point, you have to stop and they have to go on the illegal market in order to have this need satisfied.
And this notion of doctors prescribing and re-prescribing, that happened over and over and over again.
Right. And I think early on, they didn't know. At some point, they did know. And at some point, it just became a habit, or they just never thought all the way through it. Now, I don't know who they are. I'm not going to say this doctor was bad and this doctor was good. One of the things this litigation has done is made these doctors and the people who sell these pills think a little bit about, wait a minute, you know, we've got to figure out what the ecosystem of this person is. If they've got chronic pain and never going to get solved, and we can give them a little dose of this, and it's going to have to be the rest of their life. Well, that's what this was really for.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got a sprained ankle, you know, suck it up and take an aspirin.
Mm-hmm. So your bottom line is don't expect this thing to be resolved next week. We got a long way to go here.
It's my understanding that it is not progressing with near the speed that people had hoped it might.
That's Chip Robertson. He's a lawyer with Bartimus Frickleton Robertson Rader based in Leawood in Jefferson City. He's a former chief judge of the Missouri Supreme Court. Chip, so good to have you here. Thanks for giving
Wonderful
us an update.
Wonderful to see you again, Chip, Steve.
You bet,
Thank
Chip.
You.
Good to see you, too. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk Kansas City Chiefs with Greg Eklund. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, Michael Moore's sequel of sorts to Fahrenheit 911, a documentary about SNL's first superstar and a new look at famed axe murder suspect Lizzie Borden. All of that and more with our film critics tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Sports Illustrated just released its latest edition of its NFL power rankings the other day. On top of the heap, your Kansas City Chiefs. And that's at least a little surprising for a team with basically a freshman quarterback and a defense that isn't really stopping anybody these days. KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund is here to talk about this team, the early hype, and yes, a quarterback named Patrick Mahomes. Greg, welcome back. So good to have you.
Good morning, Steve. Let's put this in perspective.
You know, conversations about this team largely begin and end with this guy named Mahomes. As you look over the list of the quarterbacks who have played for this team, any early thoughts on where he's going to fit in?
Oh, well, he has a chance, obviously, from what we've seen just over the course of three games this season.
To be the best, maybe?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, from anybody who has seen, including yourself.
Yeah.
His play on the field, and for him to, at such a young stage in his career, to execute what he has been able to do, throwing the ball, running with the ball, although that doesn't look always in artisan form there.
Yeah.
But with his abilities, the strength of his arm, his intelligence at the position, his ability to see things downfield, it's uncanny.
You know, what really struck me from attending the game the other day, and again, I'm no pro football whiz, but just watching the team play, the offense particularly, just how easy the game seemed to be coming to those players. I mean, the receivers were not just a little open, they were, you know, wide open by NFL standards, and the offense just rolled right along down the field in a way that just made it look like they weren't breaking a sweat out there.
Yeah, and a lot of it was evident from that road game at Pittsburgh when you knew that the Pittsburgh Steelers were going to throw a lot of different looks at him.
Yeah.
With a pretty good defense in Pittsburgh, and he was able to handle that in an environment that wasn't friendly, and he was able to execute the game plan on the road in Pittsburgh, a place and a team that the Chiefs have had traditionally trouble with through the years, and he was able to do it beautifully.
Is it too early to assess him? I mean, we're three games in.
I don't think it's too early. No, mm-hmm. I think this is a sample of what. But there are going to be some pitfalls. It's almost, as you had mentioned, it's almost too easy the way we've seen him execute the offense and accumulate the points the way he's been able to through the first three games. But teams, there are teams that are going to be strategizing against him. This will be a good test in Monday night in Denver because they have some defensive players who can make some big time plays, and he'll be under some pressure on the road. This is not like the game at Denver he started at the end of last season when there was really nothing on the line. The Broncos very much want to get back into the AFC West, and with this game in Denver on Monday night, they want to hold serve there.
Let's do this. Let's compare Mahomes a little bit to three quarterbacks who loom large for the Chiefs in franchise history.
Sure.
If we can, let's do a one-on-one comparison with these guys and just talk about how Mahomes stacks up against them. Let's begin with Lenny Dawson, who had been playing pro ball since 57 before coming to Kansas City with the Dallas Texas team and then becoming the Chiefs later on.
Yeah, when you look at the comparison there, you are looking at a guy with Len Dawson who was a backup with the Pittsburgh Steelers, with the Cleveland Browns, but Hank Stram saw something in him to execute the kind of offense that Hank Stram had in mind, and Len Dawson was a perfect fit for the Dallas Texans at that time. He played in 1 year with the Texans before the move to Kansas City in 63.
Okay, then there's Trent Green, who had played 7 years in the NFL before he came to the Chiefs from St. Louis, Greg.
Again, great abilities. He was hurt a lot. With the Chiefs, he was finally able to, one, stay healthy, and two, because of Dick Vermeil's familiarity with him at that time, he was able to fit in with the Chiefs, and his best season was in 03 when he threw, I believe, 24 touchdown passes for the Chiefs that season. Len Dawson has the record for a touchdown passes in one season with 30 that he set in 1964, and Mahomes is well on his
way.
He's
almost halfway there with 13.
I mean,
he's three games in.
Over a 16-game season, I would expect that record to possibly be shattered.
How about the final quarterback? We're going to compare him to Steve DeBerg with 13 years in the NFL before he had his best season with the Chiefs back in 1990 when he was 36 years old.
He was 36 years old. He threw 23 touchdown passes at that time. Again, a seasoned quarterback, someone who had a lot of snaps under his belt, and a guy who was at that stage in his career a very good quarterback for the Chiefs. But the Chiefs through the years had never found a guy that they had cultivated on their own. These were guys, when you mentioned DeBerg, Green, and Lawson, all of whom had been with other organizations and then found their niche with the Chiefs.
You know, there's all this yak out there that the NFL will soon adjust to Patrick Mahomes and alter defenses to shut him down. You know something? I don't buy any of that.
Well, they'll try.
Yeah. But can you really stop someone who's as talented as he is?
Well, look at the names that he has surpassed just in the NFL records that he has set in the first 3 weeks of the season. When you're talking about being in the same class as a Peyton Manning, who set the NFL record for 55 touchdown passes in one season, he broke his record for the most touchdown passes over the first three games of a season. So, again, it lends itself to the possibility of shattering the Chiefs' record, and if he keeps it going, maybe even challenge the NFL record set by Manning.
Now, is he a good guy? Do his teammates like him?
Yeah, I think so. And I think this comes back to his background of growing up in the family of whose father was a professional athlete. I think he knows the value of leadership, even though there are two different sports. His father was a Major League Baseball pitcher, and the football locker room is a different mentality than a baseball locker room. But I think he knows and has learned the importance of leadership. He learned that at Texas Tech while he was playing with Texas Tech, and I think it has carried over to the Kansas City Chiefs.
I'm visiting with KCUR's Greg Eklund about the Kansas City Chiefs and that quarterback, that kid named Patrick Mahomes. The weapons on this offense, Greg, is it the most potent offense in the entire NFL right now?
Well, that's another thing that makes Mahomes so effective. And I think it was one of the reasons why the Chiefs made the decision after last year with Alex Smith to go in the direction that they're heading right now. They saw that they have great skill players with a running back, Kareem Hunt, a tight end like Travis Kelce, and a wide receiver Tyreek Hill, and now when you add Sammy Watkins to the mix, who has been targeted a lot over the last couple of games, it has given Mahomes a lot of options, a lot of choices as he moves the ball downfield. When you think back to when the Chiefs last tried to cultivate a quarterback on their own with a high draft pick, they drafted Todd Blackledge in the first round in the 1983 draft. I don't think Todd Blackledge, even though he did leave the Chiefs to the playoffs 1 year, but he got hurt a lot, and he didn't have the weapons around him that Mahomes has right now. The Blackledge thing never worked out for the Chiefs, and of course it turns into a nightmare when you saw other quarterbacks in 1983 drafted in that first round, like Dan Marino and John Elway, who was the first overall pick that year. And even as brief as a career as Tony Eason had with the New England Patriots, he still led them to the Super Bowl before they lost to the Bears in the Super Bowl. So there were a lot of quarterbacks drafted in the first round that year, but the Chiefs seem to have gotten this one right this time around.
Again, just watching from the stands last Sunday, watching Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes talk during the game, you can't help get a sense of two things. One, that Andy Reid is having an absolute blast working with this offense, and two, that Patrick Mahomes is a really good fit, and Andy Reid's a really good fit for Patrick Mahomes. They're lucky to be together at this point in their careers.
Yeah, before this, he had Donovan McNabb in Philadelphia, and that was probably the best and the most talented quarterback he had prior to Patrick Mahomes. But I would agree with you. This almost seems like this is the newest toy in the toy box of Andy Reid as he tinkers with plays and everything like that. And he won't come. I mean, he's very low key, but I think deep inside, I think he's having a blast.
I still am curious why Patrick Mahomes, he was the 10th player picked in the draft. I'm guessing today that there are 9 other teams who are thinking, man, we blew it. You know, a couple of years ago when we should have grabbed this guy.
Yeah, I think there are teams that are looking at themselves, most notably up in Chicago, because they took a quarterback with when they took Trubisky. And now it's a former Chiefs assistant who is trying to make something out of that pick. But there are some teams that are asking themselves why and how did we miss on this
guy? You know, Greg, just a final point. You can't help but look at this defense and conclude that this defense is going to end up breaking a lot of hearts in this town before the season's over.
Well, we've seen this before. And when you look back at the 2003 Kansas City Chiefs, Trent Green had a tremendous year, as did the entire offense for the Chiefs, but you've got to stop the other team from scoring at some point. And in the early part of the season, we've seen the Chiefs trying to outscore their opponents because they're giving up points as well.
You know, can the return of Eric Berry solve this problem?
Not necessarily. I mean, we don't know, even if he does come back, how physically able he's going to perform.
Well, that's KCOR contributor Greg Eklund. Greg, thanks for bringing us up to date on our Kansas City Chiefs. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, Steve.
Yesterday, I had a great conversation with actor-turned-author Ellie Kemper about her journey from a childhood in Missouri to a career in Hollywood. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, our film critics are here. They'll give us the latest and greatest of movies showing on the big screen. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.